From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We've heard about the adventures of undercover agents on the trail of drug dealers and gangsters. On this edition of Fresh Air, we hear about undercover agents who track down poachers and protect endangered species. We talk with environmental journalist Mark Reisner, author of the new book, Game Wars. Also today, we talk with the authors of a new gay and lesbian travel guide to Europe. It's not just about where the gay bars and bookstores are, it's about gay culture and history abroad. And classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews the new reissues of pianist Arthur Schnabel performing all 32 Beethoven piano sonatas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A massive cleanup operation is getting underway in the Philippines after last week's volcanic eruptions of Mount Pinatubo. Millions of tons of volcanic ash settled in the capital, Manila, 60 miles away, and on other surrounding towns and cities. Officials say the threat of further eruptions is diminishing, and Manila Airport may reopen in the next 2 days. Philip Short filed this report for the BBC.
Government scientists here are now sufficiently confident that the volcano is quiescent that they've halved the danger zone from 25 to 12 miles radius. There's still an acute risk of mudslips. Mount Pinatubo blew out 2 cubic kilometers of debris during its week of torment, and much of it remains scattered on the mountainside, poised to slide down at the first heavy rains. In the countryside beyond, the rice paddies are choked in grey mud, and trees lie smashed by the weight of the ashfall like matchwood in a whirlwind. Coconut palms have buckled, the bananas are stripped of their leaves, and on all sides there's a torment of tangled branches and splintered wood. A blasted landscape, like a scene from Dante's Inferno.
Philip Short in Manila. The Senate cleared the way for passage of a massive transportation bill today after settling on a way to divvy up a surplus in the Highway Trust Fund. Progress on the measure was blocked as senators argued over how much of the $8.2 billion surplus their state should get. That was resolved in a compromise proposed by West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd. Byrd's plan would give half the money to states that have paid the most into the fund in the past. The other half would be used to reward states that have made a greater than average effort to improve their transportation networks. The White House today confirmed that Chief of Staff John Sununu has been soliciting free trips aboard corporate jets ever since his use of military aircraft for personal travel was curtailed. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The White House says that corporations often provide an airplane ride as an in-kind service to organizations that invite Governor Sununu to speak, and that there is nothing illegal about this arrangement. The Los Angeles Times reports that Sununu had solicited free air travel, and that in the most recent case last Wednesday night, after appearing before a GOP fundraiser, Sununu flew home in a plane belonging to Beneficial Corporation, a New Jersey consumer credit firm. Now, that trip first attracted public attention when it was revealed that Sununu used a White House limousine to travel to a New York stamp auction. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said Sununu would have to pay taxes on that limo ride, and he promised more information on Sununu's arrangement with Beneficial Corporation. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Stock prices closed slightly lower again today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7 points to close at 2,986.8. This is NPR News. The Louisiana Senate voted today to override Governor Buddy Romer's veto of a strict new abortion bill. The bill would ban abortions except in the cases of rape or incest or to save the life of the mother. Romer had argued that the rape and incest provisions were too narrowly drawn. The state Senate mustered 3 more votes than the 2/3 majority needed to override a veto. It was the first Senate override of a governor's veto in modern Louisiana politics. The override still has to be considered by the House. The judge presiding over the trial of 4 Los Angeles police officers charged in the videotaped beating of Rodney King told the state court of appeals that he's willing to transfer the trial out of Los Angeles in order to avoid further delays. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
A change of venue out of Los Angeles would be a big victory for the defense. Attorneys for the accused officers had argued that the officers could not get a fair trial in Los Angeles because of massive pretrial publicity and because of the enormous local political and community fallout from the beating. Last week, the State Court of Appeal halted the pending trial while it considered defense arguments to move the trial out of Los Angeles. In a letter to the appellate court made public today, Judge Bernard Kamen said he was prepared to transfer the case to another county. Assuming that the appellate court agrees, the case, according to Kamen, could be transferred as early as tomorrow. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
Aides to House Majority Whip William Gray are denying rumors that the Pennsylvania Democrat intends to resign from Congress this week. Congressional sources say that Gray, the highest-ranking black legislator in Congress, plans to become president of the United Negro College Fund. Gray has served in Congress since 1979. He's currently the third-ranking member of the House Democratic leadership. One source said that Gray would submit his resignation on Thursday. Another said he's now informing his colleagues of his plans. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When we think of undercover agents, it's usually the CIA, the FBI, or the DEA that comes to mind, not the Fish and Wildlife Service. But wildlife agents are going undercover to protect endangered species from poachers and to infiltrate the international black market in the meat, skins, and bones of endangered species. My guest is environmental journalist Mark Reisner. His new book, Game Wars, is about the undercover pursuit of wildlife poachers. Reisner spent several years following around Dave Hall, a fish and wildlife agent who has gone undercover as an alligator poacher, an oil leasing businessman with a sideline in illegal furs, ivory, and cocaine, and a Mississippi caterer who specializes in illegal wild game. According to Reisner, this international black market is so lucrative, it poses a significant threat to several endangered species.
The rhinoceros, for example, which was very common in Africa 50 to 75 years ago, is now down to the last few thousand specimens. The rhinoceros may not make it outside of zoos. There are too few left. The reason is because rhinoceros horn in Korea ground up as a powder, and it's considered a sort of a thaumaturgical cure-all. It's anything from an aphrodisiac to something that will prolong your life. It's selling for $5,000 per pound, which is about what cocaine sells for. Rhinoceros horn 20 or 30 years ago didn't fetch $100 a pound. Now it's $5,000 a pound. We have a lot of rich societies, especially Asian societies, that value wildlife parts, ivory, rhinoceros horn, polar bear skins, which can sell for as much as $50,000 in Japan. And there's tremendous pressure on a lot of these species, especially species that have never been that common, like polar bears. So you have a big, thriving international black market in wildlife. It's never going to go away. And, you know, the groups like the Sierra Club, as effective as they are when it comes to things like air pollution and national park preservation, aren't really on the vanguard of the effort to save those species. It's this tiny little cadre of undercover game wardens, uniformed game wardens, and groups like Wildlife Conservation International. They are the samurai class of the conservation movement. They are out there actually doing battle, and in many cases, gun battle, with these ruthless poacher types who are going after endangered species all over the world.
Did you go to any of the black market connections?
Well, I went undercover a couple of times with Dave Hall, my protagonist, and scared the hell out of me. I mean, you can't imagine the kind of people we were out with. They stepped right off the screen in Deliverance. I don't know whether you've seen that movie. You remember those two mountain men?
Mm-hmm.
Well, those are the kinds of people we were out with. These were ruthless killers. And, the father of one of these guys had been a contract killer. That's how he made his living. He assassinated people. And they were killing wildlife, all kinds of wildlife. They were killing turtles. This is down in Louisiana. Alligators. They were netting ducks and selling them. They're big black markets throughout the South because it's a Southern tradition, especially in Cajun Louisiana, that you eat wild food. A lot of these people haven't gone to a supermarket to buy a piece of meat in years. Almost everything they eat, they kill. and almost all of it illegally.
Are these poaching rings largely made up of individuals, or is there a lot of international organized crime behind it?
Well, one of the big ivory dealers whom Dave Hall almost caught, he didn't get him essentially because the government attorneys blew the case, was a major figure in the East Coast Mafia. He was involved in all kinds of stuff, but one of his big businesses was elephant ivory. He also bought walrus ivory, but he had probably 40 people doing nothing but rendering elephant ivory into jewelry and, carvings and things like that, all of it illegal. He was making millions of dollars. He had a 12-bedroom house, three-story house, that was built largely on the profits of illegal wildlife. And this guy had two armed guards patrolling his grounds, and he had anti-bugging equipment in the house, which he said was as sophisticated as what they had in the White House. And as Dave Hall walked into his house to sell him some illegal ivory, walrus ivory, the guy said, "By the way, if you're bugged, my anti-bugging equipment is going to detect it, and you'll be killed." He walked into the house. He had on a $5,000 very sophisticated Nagra Swedish-made tape recorder, which did not set the anti-bugging equipment off. But I said, "How could you do that? How could you walk into that house when they said they'd shoot you?" He said, "Well, first of all, I was going to have my gun up first. Secondly, what am I going to do? Say, 'You got me. I'm your man.' I didn't have any choice." So these guys have, and the women as well, have nerves of very tensile steel. And I think they are to be admired.
You've talked about how great the risks are for undercover work. Have undercover fish and wildlife agents been killed?
In 1984, four were killed. These were game wardens, not all undercover. The risk, according to Dave Hall, the risk of being a game warden is 200% greater than the risk of being a city cop.
What does a game warden do exactly?
The risk of death or injury. Well, a game warden is going to go out and do everything from check fishing licenses to get in mad dog chases with deer spotlighters, guys who, shoot deer by the dozen from their cars with a big, powerful spotlight. It's a very common violation. Everybody they meet is armed, at least in hunting season, usually with a high-powered rifle. A lot of these guys are rednecks. They're basically violent people, and they hate the idea that anybody tells them they can't go out and shoot whatever they want. Some of them are doing it commercially for pretty good money, big money. You can't imagine how, and you have no backup, especially if you're undercover. An undercover drug cop has a van load of agents waiting to jump on the perpetrators. He's got surveillance up in the fourth floor window. He's got all kinds of sophisticated electronic beepers and things like that on him. If he gets in trouble, somebody's going to try to get him out of it quick. Now, Dave Hall has been undercover with illegal groups of people in the middle of nowhere, in the bayou in Louisiana, up in Alaska, big game hunters, politically very influential people who, if they were caught, could lose their careers. Now, a guide or somebody like that in the middle of nowhere discovers that one of the members of the party is an undercover game warden. What are they going to do to avoid being caught? Think about it.
The story of the alligator is an interesting case study in endangered species. And you described the alligator as one of the greatest success stories. The recovery of the alligator is one of the greatest success stories in North American wildlife conservation. When was the alligator first threatened?
I think you have to call it the greatest success story. The alligator was threatened, I would say, when Art Deco, the Art Deco age, made alligator skin fashionable. It's essentially used for urban wear, for purses, for fancy shoes, for handbags, things like that. And as we became an increasingly urban society in the 20s and 30s, and alligators became very fashionable, you can go to an Art Deco show and find clocks made out of alligator skins. The species was overhunted at a spectacular rate. Florida had something like 2,200,000 alligators probably around World War I. By 1968, there were about 40,000 left, almost all of them in the Everglades. And the poachers were going in there with impunity at night and hunting alligators. One state after another lost its alligators, lost 97, 98, 99% of them. So it became an endangered species, a federally listed endangered species. It was one of the first ones put on the list back in the late 60s. But still, there were 2,000 people who were used to making their living from killing alligators. And some of these guys were making, you know, $100,000 a year back then, which was 10 or 20 times more money than they could make doing anything else. So they just wouldn't stop. And the game wardens could go out and try to chase them down in airboats and things like that. But these were very wily, well-organized poaching gangs. And it was mainly Dave Hall organizing a bunch of front operations that bought illegal alligators and then busted the people who sold them that shut down this whole network that ranged all the way to Japan of alligator smugglers and tanners and dealers. And finally, when the hunters had no one to sell to anymore, the alligator recovered amazingly. Louisiana has probably 600,000 to 700,000 now, as opposed to maybe 50,000 20 years ago.
I know I was just in New Orleans for a conference, and it had rained really hard before I got there, and I was told that it was really hard to get anywhere because there were alligators all over the road. How did the alligators make such an incredible comeback after being an endangered species?
Well, it's an adaptable animal. It's a lot like deer. You know, deer were very scarce in New England 200 years ago because everybody hunted them for food. Now we probably have more deer in this country than we had 200 years ago. Same thing with the alligator. They once they're, you know, left reasonably alone, there is a legal alligator season now. They take about 40 or 50,000 a year. But that's I hate to use the word harvest, but that's what the game management people use. That is a manageable kill. You're not going to endanger the species by taking that many. And alligators have learned to coexist with human beings quite well, at least in the core of their habitat. They used to range all the way up to southern Illinois. I don't think we're ever going to see alligators that far north again. But the populations in Florida, in Alabama, and Louisiana, where they're quite thick, seem to be stable.
Let me ask you, when you go to New Orleans, there's a lot of alligator dishes on the menu. Do you eat alligator? Would you eat it? Do you think that...
I had it once.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it's very good.
Well, beyond the taste, what do you think, you know, ethically about eating alligators? Any problem with that?
Well, I think that in order to save wild species, it's a sad fact that they have to have some commercial value. Maybe not species like the bald eagle, which has an intrinsic value as our national bird, but species like deer, species like ducks. If it weren't for the deer hunters and the duck hunters, we wouldn't have any habitat left because those are the people who really give a damn about saving habitat. And the same applies to the alligator. So I think it's a sad but true fact that people who are interested in wildlife conservation have to accept the premise that wildlife has to be hunted to some degree, within manageable constraints, and that it's the hunters who really, you know, the wildlife user types. I'm talking about groups like Ducks Unlimited, who have really gone the extra mile to save habitat. Groups like Friends of Animals are essentially opposed to hunting, and I can understand that ethically, but Friends of Animals has not bought 2 million acres of waterfowl habitat in Canada as Ducks Unlimited has done.
So you're not against hunting?
No, I'm not.
And you think that the hunters, in a way, are really helping to save... Some hunters are helping to save some species because they have a vested interest in making sure that the species propagate.
Unfortunately so. Of course, you have good ethical hunters like Aldo Leopold, who was a big hunter, and then you have trash hunters. You have the commercial hunters who are really the equivalent of the Medellin cartel. Wildlife to them is just an opportunity to make a lot of money. And if the species goes extinct, that's too bad. Those are the people that undercover wildlife agents like Dave Hall are obsessed with catching.
Are there any lessons that we can learn from the revival of the alligator that can be applied to other endangered species?
Sure. First of all, we have to save habitat. We're losing habitat all the time. We've got a policy that now allegedly of no net loss of wetlands. We're still losing 400,000 to 500,000 acres of wetlands per year. We're just nibbling away at the edges of the miserable little vestiges of wildlife habitat, of good wildlife habitat that we have left. If we're serious about having wild creatures around us, and I don't know how you can measure their value. I mean, I can't imagine a world without wildlife. I'd like to see a lot more than we have, and that's possible. But we have to, first of all, not just save habitat, but recreate it. We've lost so much habitat that we have to get serious now about recreating habitat. And we're doing that to some degree in some places. We're doing that, for example, in Chesapeake Bay, where there's an enormous citizen effort to restore the health of that estuary. But we're losing it at a fantastic rate in Florida. We're losing it in southern Louisiana. We're losing it in California, most of the western states.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Reisner, and he's an investigative environmental reporter. His new book is called Game Wars, The Undercover Pursuit of Wildlife Poachers. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Mark Reisner is my guest, author of the new book, Game Wars, The Undercover Pursuit of Wildlife Poachers. You looked at poaching in the south of Louisiana and in Alaska, among other places. And in Louisiana and in Alaska, there were native populations who were in part responsible for the poaching. You raise the issue in your book of the need to teach native cultures a conservation ethic. What are some of the problems involved in doing that? I mean, I think that in some of these cases, the native cultures aren't used to a conservation ethic because there's a tradition of living off the land. And what is more basic than that? I mean, how do you tell somebody, well, you can't live off the land anymore?
Well, let's put it this way. The Eskimos in Alaska didn't have a cash economy. They didn't know what money was until about 40 years ago. They hunted for subsistence, meaning they hunted for food, they hunted for clothing, they hunted a walrus to make skin boats, which they went out in. They didn't have high-powered motors, they didn't have snowmobiles, so they didn't have, high-powered rifles. It was very difficult for them to take a lot of animals. It was a treacherous, dangerous, difficult business. Now they have essentially army-scale weaponry. And they have things like satellite television, things like cocaine and marijuana that they want to spend money on. So they are out there, waging war against the species that they've always depended on, so they can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on all these accoutrements of civilization that they've now been taught that they want and need. So subsistence is a joke. There's a subsistence exemption in the Endangered Species Act that allows Eskimos essentially to hunt as many animals as they want. But what they're doing is selling them clandestinely to big white smugglers and buying all of these things that they never thought they needed in the past. That subsistence business really has to be rethought and revised, or not just the animals, but the culture itself is going to go out.
So you think that consumer culture has corrupted native cultures, and in turn native cultures hunt in a different way and hunt for different reasons than they once did?
Absolutely. It's a terrible tragedy.
You know, a lot of people think that a lot of environmentalists are really very naive in the way they approach things, and I wonder if, after writing Game Wars, you think there are parts of the environmental movement that indeed are naive.
Well, I've always felt that. I think, people who think the only way to save wildlife is to ban hunting are completely off base. The way to save wildlife is to keep hunting legal, regulate it severely, and as Hall does again and again, turn these poacher types into born-again conservationists. He doesn't just arrest these guys, he converts them. And they've become some of his strongest evangelical conservation types. There's a guy named Dennis Treitler who made his living as an outlaw for the last 25, 30 years. Dave Hall finally put him in jail. And when he got out, went and preached conservation at him so effectively that Treitler now is running all over the South to Hutter groups, Boone and Crockett clubs, and giving that same message out. He spoke to the National Convention of Ducks Unlimited. George Bush was there. You know, you have a lot of rich hunter types, not just these sort of hillbilly types who are taking, you know, serious over limits of ducks because they think, oh, we're rich, real rich guys, so we can do whatever we want. You know, Treitler just poured a whole bucket load of venom on them as well.
Are you still in touch with Dave Hall, the undercover agent who you write about in your book?
Oh, very much so. We're going to be collaborating on a movie, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, based on his life.
A theatrical film?
Yes. First run, I hope. We're working with a couple of Hollywood producers right now, trying to iron out the deal.
And who does he see as playing Dave Hall?
Well, he would like to see Robert Redford, who has expressed an interest. Redford, I'm not sure is the right kind of guy.
Real tough as leather kind of guy, huh?
Yeah. Clint Eastwood would make a better Dave Hall than Robert Redford. I've always said that Dave Hall is a combination of Clint Eastwood and David Brower. But I don't know who's going to end up doing it.
Our producer suggests Ed Harris.
Ed Harris would be pretty good. Tommy Lee Jones would be excellent. He even looks like Dave Hall. Thank you. Thank your producer very much for that tip.
I'll take credit for the Tommy Lee Jones suggestion.
Tommy Lee Jones. That's good. I like that. I like that. Because Dave Hall is part Indian, and he has a little of that, you know, part Indian look. He has some acne scars on his face. He's a very rough-looking guy. You never believe this guy is a law enforcement officer. He looks like a real hoodlum.
So you don't think you have a future in undercover work, huh?
Well, it's intoxicating. I found it, you know, undercover people say if you can get used to the danger, it's as addictive as drugs, and I can see that. It was very addictive, that living on that margin, on that threshold. And, you know, these guys have, their family life is often in ruins. And there are women who do it as well, and their family life is in ruins. The divorce rate is astronomical, something like 75%. They're gone so much, they're living on the edge, and they become obsessed. But you have to be not just obsessed with what you're doing, you have to be obsessed with your goal, whether you're trying to get rid of the scourge of narcotics or the scourge of poaching. You have to be absolutely committed, because if you think to yourself, why the hell am I doing this anyway? Why am I taking serious risks for an alligator? Then you're done. You're doomed. And many of them quit when they start thinking that way.
Mark Reznor, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Mark Reznor is an environmental investigative journalist. He's the author of the new book, Game Wars, The Undercover Pursuit of Wildlife Poachers. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lindsay Van Gelder and Pamela Robin Brandt have written a new travel guide to Europe for gays and lesbians. It features essays on gay culture and history abroad, as well as practical information about hotels, bars, bookstores, and restaurants. Coming up, we talk with the authors about some of their own adventures traveling together abroad. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new 8-CD set of the complete Beethoven piano sonatas, performed by one of the century's greatest pianists, Arthur Schnabel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Washington, the Bush administration is moving closer to lifting sanctions against South Africa, and debate on the issue is heating up again in the nation's capital. NPR's Ted Clark has more on the story.
The Bush administration says South Africa has met four of the five conditions for lifting U.S. sanctions, four of the five conditions spelled out in the Anti-Apartheid Act. All that's left, the administration says, is for South Africa to free the remaining political prisoners, and that could happen within a month. But that's too soon to lift sanctions in the view of some key sponsors of the Anti-Apartheid Act. Today, Senator Alan Cranston of California denied that South African authorities have satisfied four of the five conditions.
It is obvious that these requirements will not be satisfied fully until a new constitution is in place.
But the Anti-Apartheid Act does not specifically demand a new South African constitution, and another architect of the act, Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, said this week it would be wrong for the U.S. to arbitrarily move the goalposts now. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
In London, the British government has strongly objected to a draft treaty of a so-called federal Europe. Speaking today in Parliament, Prime Minister John Major said that a European superstate is not acceptable. Britain has stood virtually alone in opposing a united Europe that would include a single European currency. Portugal and Denmark also are said to have reservations about the federal concept. The Pentagon says that in the wake of volcanic eruptions, evacuations of two U.S. military bases in the Philippines continues. Officials also say that talks with the Philippine government over the future of those bases are now on hold. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Pentagon spokesman Bob Hall says the eruption of Mount Pinatubo caused extensive damage at Clark Air Base and Subic Bay Naval Station. Up to 2 feet of rock and ash has fallen on Clark, even more on Subic, where 50 buildings were damaged, mostly by falling roofs. Hall says the extensive damage at the bases has put their future up in the air.
It's too early to say what impact this disaster is going to have on, this natural disaster will have on our ability to conduct operations out of, of those bases. So we don't really know what the interrelationship is going to be with either the talks or the negotiations or with our future operations there.
Hall says more than 5,700 Americans have been evacuated to the Philippines island of Cebu. From there, they will be flown to Guam and then on to the continental U.S. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 7 points to close at 2,986.81. On volume of some 154 million shares, declining issues led advances by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News. In Louisiana, the state Senate has voted to override the governor's veto of an anti-abortion bill that supporters say will be the toughest in the nation. The Senate vote was 29-9, three more votes than needed to override. The House, which voted overwhelmingly in favor of the abortion bill, will now consider the governor's veto. And if two-thirds vote to override the veto, the bill becomes law. In Nicaragua, Sandinista supporters in the capital have taken over City Hall and a radio station, protesting efforts to overturn property laws set up when they were in power. Vivian Altman reports.
Conservative lawmakers are threatening to overturn two controversial property laws. These politicians say that laws were passed by the Sandinistas to protect houses and land taken by them after they lost the election. For their part, the Sandinistas argue that these laws were passed to protect property given out to more than 1 million poor Nicaraguans during the 11 years of Sandinista rule. Angry trade unionists and local activists marched to Parliament as Sandinista lawmakers announced their decision to withdraw from the House indefinitely. Conservative legislators are expected to send the hotly disputed laws to a special House committee. And representatives from government, business and labour have also called on the House to hold off overturning the laws pending some kind of negotiated solution. For National Public Radio, I'm Vivian Altman in Managua.
Members of the European community have agreed on certain conditions for the sale of firearms. Trade ministers agreed that all arms deals must be approved by various government officials and records kept of the guns sold. Sales of handguns will be allowed only to people 18 years of age and older and deemed not to be a danger to public order. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Imagine if the reflective travel writer Paul Theroux and the travel guide king Arthur Frommer could have a baby together and the kid grew up to write gay guidebooks. That's how my guests described their new book, Are You Two Together? A Gay and Lesbian Travel Guide to Europe. It includes essays about gay culture and history abroad, practical information on where to find gay bars, bookstores, restaurants, and hotels, as well as personal reflections about the author's travels together. Lindsay Van Gelder and Pamela Robin Brandt have been a couple since 1978. They're both journalists. Brandt used to sing with the women's rock band Deadly Nightshade. They say they hope their new book will give aid and comfort to gay and lesbian couples who don't want to choose between spending their entire vacation in the gay ghetto or else sleeping separately and never holding hands at dinner.
Everybody deserves a first-class vacation, and so do we. I think it's one of those things like when gay people ask for equal rights, some people assume that we mean special privileges. This is not true. We don't think we deserve a more first-class vacation than anybody else. But we do think that we deserve a vacation that's not an absolute minefield. And for gay people, travel is often a minefield.
When you would travel to a city you hadn't been to before, how would you scope out the gay parts of the city? Or, you know, when I say the gay parts of the city, I mean, you know, hotels that welcome gays and restaurants and bars and so on.
Well, actually, there are 14 destinations that we focus on in the book, and except for two of them, we had been to them all before as travelers, so we weren't really starting completely from scratch. Another thing is that most of the hotels that we list are not specifically gay hotels. We list some of those. We think some people, you know, think it's fun to stay at a gay-owned hotel, and sometimes they're the best in town.
And we make that perfectly clear when they are intended for gay people.
But what we mostly did was we would go into a town, particularly when we were writing about a small town, and just pick the hotels that we thought were the most charming, the best value for budget travelers. And we would go up to the proprietors and do what we called the drill, where we would ask them if our readers would be welcome. And most of the time, they were.
What would they tell you when they weren't?
Well, I remember there was one hotel that was even gay-owned in Amsterdam, and they virtually slammed the door in our faces. But we realized later, after getting them to reopen the door, that what they had assumed when we said originally that we were writing a gay guide is that this was going to be a guide for guys who like to walk around the halls in togas and come down to breakfast without any clothes on. Once we explained that we were not really toga kind of gals ourselves, it turned out to be fine. They had been listed in another gay guide. A lot of the gay guides now are basically name and address lists, and it's mostly names and addresses of bars and baths, which is all fine. But
if that's what you want.
If that's what you want, but most of the gay people we know don't want to spend their entire vacations in bars and baths.
You point out that it's sometimes hard for gays and lesbians to ask for a room with a double bed and not get, you know, this look of shock from the hotel clerk who's checking you in. But that's never happened to you, right?
Oh, yes, that's happened to us all the time. For some people, this is a fairly traumatic part of the vacation. And for other people, it's at least sort of annoying. It's annoying to us to have to go into a hotel and have people look at us funny and give us a little quiz about, are you sure you want that kind of a bed?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I remember one town in France where we had to continually insist that we just wanted a room with one double bed, and finally what they tried to fix us up with was two rooms, each with a double bed. Seemed a little excessive.
The one thing that people really should know if they're traveling to Europe is that in most parts of Europe, that's the worst that's going to happen to you is this kind of snippy, snotty, do you really want this kind of question. In most of Europe, you're not going to get hit over the head with a baseball bat, which is what can happen to you in the United States.
However, it can happen in Europe. There were some friends of ours in Nice, which is a very cosmopolitan city. You would expect that they had seen everything and would know better. They did the usual thing. They had arrived at the train station, had a lot of luggage. One of them stayed in the train station with the luggage so as not to have to schlep it around the whole town. The other one went, found a perfectly cute, beautiful little hotel, garden, everything. Went back, got a room with a double bed. Went back, got her friend, and then when the landlady realized that it was going to be two women sharing this double bed, she ripped the key out of their hands and started screaming at them in the lobby in front of a lot of other hotel guests.
Now, you found that a lot of gay-oriented hotels and restaurants have what you call a gay tax.
Well, usually the typical situation for gay people traveling is they will take a hotel that may be overpriced, that may be absolutely charmless, not even clean, in the sex district, all of this for the wonderful privilege of not being spat on by the proprietors. We call this the gay tax, and we don't think that people should have to pay it. You know, we think that, you know, we should get to stay in whatever is the nicest hotel in town for your price range, whether it's gay or straight.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Lindsay Van Gelder and Pamela Robin Brandt. They've co-authored a new book called Are You Two Together? A Gay and Lesbian Travel Guide to Europe. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Lindsay Van Gelder and Pamela Robin Brandt are my guests, co-authors of the new book, Are You Two Together? A Gay and Lesbian Travel Guide to Europe. Do you do things when you're traveling, let me put it this way, do you go places when you're traveling that are the equivalent of places that you probably wouldn't go to at home?
Oh, to do the research for this book, we went to a male brothel, which is not usually on our hit parade at home. But we did think we owed it to some of our readers to check out gay scenes that we might not personally be interested in.
Did you go to a lot of the gay bars when you were traveling to check them out for your book?
Many more than we normally do at home. In fact, you know, we got to the point where I would be sort of saying to Pamela, oh, you know, I just can't stand to go out and party for another hour. You know, this is too much work.
Our friends do not feel sorry for us, on the other hand. We went to a different kind of bar than I think is listed in most of the other gay guides, though. We deliberately concentrated on places that were not cruise-oriented. What we think are really good resources, and which we list, as a matter of fact, in our book, are bookstores, for example. Bookstore owners of gay bookstores in a lot of the towns that we listed are more than happy to show you all of the gay periodicals, which are absolutely the most up-to-date listings of gay facilities in the town, and local gay publications, which are not available in this country and which also tend to be more up-to-date about what's really open and what isn't. And they will hand-mark those things for you. Sometimes they'll even go around and bar-hop with you.
Well, we recognized as we did the research for this book that there really is an international gay community, that when you go to a bar or a bookstore or a center in Europe, or when you sort of follow in the footsteps of sort of, you know, the great gay people in history, that you do see yourself reflected. And many of the bars that we picked to list were places where you could really meet other people.
I think that must be a very nice thing to have, because if you're not part of a community like that when you're traveling, there isn't a place necessarily where you can go to where you feel this immediate sense of connection with other people there, where they'll go out of their way for you. I mean, you're just going to be another tourist in most places.
Yeah, we really ended up feeling that for all of the hassles that gay travelers risk encountering, that we really had a resource that straight travelers typically don't. I mean, a lot of straight Americans who go to Europe will they'll encounter desk clerks and taxi drivers and you know, people who work as waiters in restaurants. And to get a little beyond that takes a lot of work. It's really quite easy for gay people to meet their counterparts in Europe and to make friends.
Well, what about just a sense of openness? Were there countries or places that you felt were more open in Europe than you'd expect to find, you know, as compared to even the major cities in the United States?
Well, certainly almost all of Northern Europe, specifically Holland, Denmark, West Germany, I mean, they have gay movements and they have gay resources that tend to be more advanced than what we have here. I think a lot of Americans kind of have this idea that we invented the gay movement, and it's not true. And when you get over there, you see, well, first of all, they had a gay movement before we did. That things were going on in the 20s in Paris and in the 30s in Germany that were really precursors of Stonewall and the gay movement in the United States.
I think there's also, you have to talk about the countries individually, because each country, even though that it is Europe, of course, each country has a very individual character. And in Italy, for example, there's a very open sexuality, even on the streets. But that's sexuality. That would be gay sexuality. As far as gay identity goes, there's none. Which is probably the opposite of what goes on in this country.
Yeah, there was just a poll, in fact, about how the Italians felt about different groups in their country. And the gays were the third least popular group. The only people who were more unpopular were gypsies and politicians. So that's not a place where I would particularly want to live as a lesbian, although as a gay tourist, you're not particularly affected by those attitudes.
Lesbians are in a lot of ways more invisible than gay men are. For instance, a lot of straight people really pride themselves on being able to spot gay men. They speak with a lisp, yeah. They have a mincing walk, and they sing lots of show tunes, right? But but like these books of stereotypes give you like no clues how to spot a lesbian. So how do you think that works like for you or against you when you're traveling as a lesbian couple in different countries? That invisibility.
Well, I think sometimes when two women show up at a hotel and ask for a double bed, the proprietors will not instantly assume that they are lesbians. They might think that they're just cheap. You know, women have less money. Double beds are often cost less money in Europe. We made a point out of telling these people that we were lesbians just in case they missed it. But what you say is true. And we found as researchers that even though we are female, it was really easy for us in every city that we went to really plug in very fast to gay male culture, you know, meet gay men who would show us around, find out exactly what was there for them. Gay male history is often pretty accessible. We had to work at finding the lesbian stuff.
But we did list some of it. For example, in Leuven, in Belgium, where we went, we had written them a note beforehand to one of the women's bars in town, the primary women's bar. And they had a note up in the bathroom that just, it didn't say two American female authors are going to be in town. It just said two American lesbians are going to be in town and gave when it was that we were going to be at the bar. And zillions of people showed up.
The
whole town showed up. So really, any American lesbian could do the same.
Those particular lesbians really wanted to sort of pin us up against the wall and find out, you know, which American movie stars were and weren't. And we had to disappoint them. They had high hopes for Tina Turner. You know, sorry, folks.
What else were they expecting you to do? I mean, since they had no idea you were writers or that you were writing a travel book, what were they expecting?
But again,
you to do?
I think that there is this growing recognition, certainly within Europe, because of 1992 and the letting down of borders, the gay movements in the different countries of Europe are really getting very well connected with each other. There is a sense now, I think, among gay people that we are a worldwide culture, and we have a lot of curiosity about each other.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lindsay Van Gelder and Pamela Robin Brandt are the authors of Are You Two Together? A Gay and Lesbian Travel Guide to Europe.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. As South Africa repeals its Racial Registration Act, we take up the issue of disinvestment in South Africa. One advisor to corporations in this country says nothing changes until the democratic movement in South Africa says the time has come to recommend that U.S. corporations invest. Linda Wertheimer talks about the Democratic Party's future, who is going to be running for president in 1992. Secretary of State James Baker traveling in Europe, talking about the economic forecast of that region. And we'll also talk with Charles Bailey, the author of a new novel entitled The Land Was Ours. He will recall the legendary political oratory of William Jennings Bryan.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz is happy. The complete set of Beethoven piano sonatas, recorded by Arthur Schnabel in the 1930s, has finally been reissued by Angel EMI on a set of 8 compact discs. Lloyd says these performances are one of the landmarks of recording history.
I don't think any musician ever thought about Beethoven's 32 piano sonatas more deeply than Arthur Schnabel. He was the first performer to record all of them. He even edited his own edition of the scores, which is so full of his acquired wisdom it reads almost like a diary. His Beethoven recordings remain the most profound explorations of these works I've ever heard. They're not monuments of perfection. They're too personal, too volatile. Yet when I want to hear what a Beethoven sonata ought to sound like, I turn to Schnabel. Perhaps Schnabel's greatest achievement was the way he played slow music. His phrasing seems to reflect the very process of thinking. Each note leads inexorably to the next. A Schnabel slow movement is an interior drama. Listen to the opening bars of the brief adagio of the Waldstein Sonata. The fate of the world seems to depend on what the next note will be. For a long time, I thought Schnabel failed only once, in the Moonlight Sonata of all things. His playing seemed clipped and choppy, lacking continuity. This most atmospheric of sonatas had no atmosphere. But a friend of mine played me a copy of the original 78s, and although the surface noise was unusually scratchy, I could hear things I never heard on the LP transfers. Haunting overtones that connected the notes had evidently been lost by the engineers in their attempt to muffle the surface noise. What a relief to discover that the fault wasn't Schnabel's. Now with the Schnabel Beethoven sonatas freshly remastered on the new compact discs, you no longer need the 78s to hear Schnabel's real performance of the Moonlight. Schnabel was particularly famous for Beethoven's profound and unorthodox late sonatas. Here's one of the most astonishing passages ever recorded. It's in the last movement of the Opus 110, Beethoven's next-to-last piano sonata. A melancholy song, Arioso Dolente, has just interrupted the movement for a second time. Then everything stops. There's a crescendo of 13 increasingly complex chords. It's a moment of sheer terror, a look directly down into the abyss, before the music proceeds to its ultimately heroic conclusion. Schnabel never stopped searching. After a concert in New York in 1951, he told his son, the pianist Carl Ulrich Schnabel, that he finally figured out how to play the last line of the Opus 90 sonata convincingly. It was his last concert. Let's hear how unconvincingly he played this ending in 1932.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a set of Angel EMI compact discs featuring Arthur Schnabel performing Beethoven. Our reviews and interviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tuohy, our associate producers. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Two years ago, Amy Tan's first novel, The Joy Luck Club, was hailed as an astonishing literary debut. On the next edition of Fresh Air, Amy Tan talks with us about her new novel, The Kitchen God's Wife. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.